Rare Bird Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, LA poet, musician, performer, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Today I am very pleased to have as my guest LA writer Corey Greathouse. How are you, Corey?
I'm fabulous, Rich. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
We're so formal here today on Poet Escape. Corey Greathouse is a writer, a runner, a reformed relocator, and a founding member of the Hollywood Institute of Poetics. She has read nationwide, and her work has been published in such places as the Toronto Quarterly and Falling Star magazine. Recognized by the City of LA for her work in bringing literary arts to the community, she also volunteers tutoring homeless children through School on Wheels and works with aspiring readers as part of the Adult Literacy Program of the LA Public Library. Her latest release is a novella entitled Another Name for Autumn, released by Black Hill Press. You know, speaking of your latest work, Corey, why don't we go ahead and begin today's show by having you tell the listeners a little about Another Name for Autumn and what inspired you to write it.
Another Name for Autumn was largely inspired by solitude. And what happens when one is so wounded that they withdraw, and what it takes in order to re-engage the world.
You know, New England and LA, you know, your main character talks about her experiences in both of those places, and both locales play important roles in this story. Can you talk about what each of those areas of the country mean to you personally?
Yeah, I lived in New England, Northampton, Massachusetts, to be specific, for almost 5 years. And I think it's impossible to go to Northampton and not fall in love with that town. I went out there initially to visit and interview for a job that was in Worcester. I was a credit risk analyst for a financial corporation at the time. And I spent 4 days in Northampton. When I went back, they offered me a really great job, which I turned down, elected to quit my job, cash out my 401k, move to Northampton, deciding that I was going to write, paint, and just get by. And that's what I did.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, what about Los Angeles? What does our fine city mean to you?
It's home.
Yeah.
It's home. There's something so familiar about every face you see in Los Angeles. And, you know, I was thinking on the way here about running the LA Marathon, which I did a couple of weeks ago.
And yeah, actually, that was something I wanted to congratulate you on.
Thank you. Just
like, I was almost going to start the show that way, but you know, that's a big deal. What was that like?
It's amazing. It is everything LA is. You start up at Dodger Stadium. You know, you get to run through Chinatown, through Silver Lake, Echo Park, like all of the incredible communities that make LA such a beautiful cultural experience. And when you're running and you see a sign on the side of the road, and the person who's holding the sign, you've no idea who they are, but you know they love someone who's out there. You know that they're out there at 7 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday holding a sign that says, "Si se puede," you know, and when you see that, no matter what language you speak, you know that you can too.
Yeah.
You know? And as I was running, I kept thinking, oh, you know, my name is Shannon, my name is Michael, my name is Dad, my name is Mom. Every sign, you know, you get to feel the love that people have for each other.
Yeah.
And it's such an incredible, powerful love that it is able to overcome the body and really push you when your muscles are giving, and you don't think you can go any further when it's 84 degrees outside and you're at mile 15 and you've got 11 miles to go and you wish you were dead.
Yeah, you know, just even aside from like just that endurance aspect of it, you know, something that just crossed my mind, you know, LA is a culture where we spend so much time in our cars, you know, either stuck in traffic or zooming along on the freeway, you know, on those off hours at, you know, 70, 80 miles an hour, and running through the city, through these great areas, you know, where everything must just slow down to such a great degree where it's just you are able to see so many things that you wouldn't necessarily see before if you were just stuck in your car. I mean, what was that like to just experience the city in that way?
It's beautiful. The potholes seem far fewer, actually, when you're running than when you're driving. I don't know how that is. Maybe they plan the route around the potholes. But you notice things on buildings. You notice house numbers, people in windows,
right?
People sitting at cafes, and then, you know, on the route I'm making a mental list of all these places that I'd like to go, and I'd like to stop there, and I can't remember any of them now.
Yeah.
I'll have to go run it again next year.
Yeah.
And, you know, really commit it to memory or something.
Nice. What kind of training went into just getting ready to run something like that?
Honestly, not much.
Oh.
Usually it takes a lot, but I wouldn't recommend doing what I did to anyone. But I injured myself in 2012 training for San Francisco and had a really rough 18 months of setbacks and re-injury, and, you know, it's a lot like writing,
mm-hmm.
frustration, and 5 weeks before the race, I decided I was going to go out and I was going to run a half marathon, and then if I could run a half marathon without pain, then the next week I would go out and I would run 18 miles, and if I could run 18 miles without pain, then I would run the marathon, because I can suck it up through, you know, the rest of the race. So I only ran three long runs before the race.
Yeah.
So I didn't really train. I just sort of.
Well,
I just didn't really prepare. I wasn't physically prepared, but I was mentally prepared.
Good.
And
well,
that's
actually,
more important.
This sort of touches on something that I wanted to ask you about. You know, you mentioned before the parallels between riding and running, and I'm curious, what are some of the parallels you see, and also how one might inform the other?
I love this. I love talking about this. So whether I'm sitting down to write or heading out for a run, the most important part is getting started, right? If I'm writing, it's sitting down and taking out my computer and opening whatever I'm working on. If I'm running, it's lacing up my shoes and getting out the door, you know, and then I start. And some days, it's really great from the first step. It all feels inspired and wonderful, and this applies to running and writing. And other days, it sucks for the first 6 miles, and you just keep running. You just keep going, and eventually you catch up to yourself.
Right.
Eventually you hit that zone where your form locks in and you hit your stride and everything starts to feel natural.
Right.
But you have to struggle through the uncomfortable parts, and the only way to do that is to keep going.
Right.
Like if I stopped running every time a run didn't begin the way I wanted it to, I would never get enough running in to run a marathon.
Yeah.
And likewise, if I stopped writing every time something didn't start out perfectly or feel inspired, I would never finish anything.
Yeah. Do you think that running has made you a different writer or more, how should I say, a seasoned writer or a more disciplined writer? That was what I was looking for, a disciplined writer?
Yes, because running has given me, aside from, you know, my book, it's given me the greatest evidence that putting in the work on a daily basis will get you to your goal. It will. You have a goal, and then you make a plan, and then you do the things on the plan, irrespective of how you feel that day, and you're going to meet your goal.
Yeah.
You're going to get there.
Yeah. You know, we were talking about L.A. before, and I kind of want to touch back on that. In the book, there's an interesting line where your character says, it's easier to forget in Los Angeles. And it was a line that I loved and I could totally relate to on different levels. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that idea.
Absolutely. I love that line. It's easier to forget in Los Angeles. I didn't realize that was true until I moved to New England and came back. And what I learned was that so much more of our memory is sensory than I had realized. Not having seasons allows things to blend together. When every day is sunny, I think people spend less time in introspection. You can go outside, you can look at everything and everyone going on around you. There aren't a lot of days in LA where the weather isn't beautiful, where you're almost forced to be inside with yourself, your
right.
thoughts, love them or hate them, and where you are given the gift of that time. Because it really is a gift.
Yeah.
You know, and in LA, it takes... For a lot of people, I think, a certain discipline to have that time. There's so much happening, and so much of it's fun or interesting that it's easier to forget that there are things going on inside and outside of ourselves that are... maybe less joyful?
Yeah. Yeah, that was one mm-hmm. of the first... After I'd been here in L.A. for a little bit of time, that was actually... It's funny you should mention it in those particular terms. That was one of the things that I realized that... And very consciously that L.A. was... In an interesting way, was going to force me to become more disciplined because it would become so easy to get distracted, to always go to like the next cool art event or go to see the next cool band that was playing, and consequently, I would have no time left for creativity. So it really demanded that I be very conscious of making that time for myself to be insular, to stay inside, to, you know, tell my friends, no, I can't do this because I have to stay home and I have to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and in New England, each season has very different sounds, very different smells, a very different type of beauty. And in Los Angeles, with the exception of June... All of the months are relatively the same. June is so beautiful because
yes.
it's this wonderful gloom all of the time. If you're lucky, the sun comes out by noon. And I love that.
It's great.
But in New England, when I reflect on my time in New England, it's so much easier to place when something happened. Oh, when was that? Well, was there snow or was there not snow? Was I wearing a dress or was I wearing, you know, a parka and trying to stay warm? We don't have that here, and I miss that. I was actually just this morning, I saw that an artist I like is doing a show in Northampton next month, and I thought, maybe I'll go for some spring.
Nice.
Just go get a little bit of the spring experience. I'm planning on running a marathon in upstate New York in November.
Oh, that'll be a great time of year to be there.
Won't that be so beautiful? I can't imagine a more beautiful way to experience autumn in New England or upstate New York, that's not New England,
right.
than to run 26.2 miles and see the leaves and maybe slip on one or two.
Well, let's hope not that. Yeah, you can get your experience, you know, dodging potholes in L.A. and then when you go out there, you'll be seasoned at being able to jump over the leaves,
mm-hmm.
the leaf piles. You know, speaking of New England and Los Angeles, there are certain things in the book that are left slightly open-ended. For example, where she's located in New England and L.A. are a bit of a mystery. The main character remains nameless. Her physical descriptions are left fairly minimal. I'm curious, was that a conscious decision, and if so, why?
It was all very intentional. Actually, when I first started this book, my original intention was to also leave the characters without gender. But that was so well executed by Jeanette Winterson in Written on the Body that I did not think I could measure up to that.
Right.
And so I decided not to even attempt it. And that probably the best homage I could pay to what she did in that book was to not even try to do it myself.
Right.
And, you know, I trust the reader. And my favorite writers also trust their readers.
Yeah.
It's very important for me as a reader to be able to see parts of my life in the story, whether they're just people who I knew or places I've been. And by not naming the specific locations or, you know, an address or a very specific part of the city, I like to allow the reader the latitude to place it wherever their New England is.
Yeah.
If your New England is Nashua, New Hampshire, then it will be Nashua, New Hampshire when you read it. The only reference to her location in the book, the only specific reference, is when she talks about being 26 blocks from the ocean.
Right.
Which could be any number of places. But she says it is 26 blocks from my apartment in Los Angeles to the sea.
Yeah.
And
which could put her on 26th Street in Santa Monica.
or any number
or
of places.
Yeah.
So I really, you know, if you're counting long blocks, it could be a lot further. And the lack of a name was extraordinarily intentional, as was the lack of physical description. I wanted her to be able to be anyone. Because I do not think that the things that we feel are unique so much. And I think that's part of what we miss when we look at other people. You know, we're so focused on our experience and what we're struggling with that we, you know, some jerk cuts you off in traffic and you wish him dead, not realizing or not consciously thinking at that moment that he's having his own struggles. And, you know, maybe he's rushing because someone's dying. You don't know.
Yeah.
And I think that by allowing her to be both nameless and all the, you know, void of physical description, it allows the reader to see more of themselves in her and to not focus on the differences, but
yeah.
to instead be able to focus on the similarities, which are in the way we feel.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting the how you sort of left so many things unidentified. It almost gave her, and really the tone of the whole book, this ethereal, almost floating quality, which really kind of matches what she's going through as a character, her sort of disappearing or her ethereal floating quality and sort of trying to find herself and what she's going through. You know, in regards to the main character, her feelings and experiences, what would be some of her experiences that you could say are, let's say, more universal, and which ones would you feel are particularly close to you?
I think that the things that are most universal are also those that are particularly close to me.
Right.
I think they're the same things. I think that we all experience loss in different forms.
Yeah.
And, you know, she talks about multiple different types of loss. And, you know, actually the excerpt that I brought talks about that. And I have experienced a lot of loss mm-hmm. in my life. You know, I lost my mother when I was 13 to cancer. My brother to a car accident when I was 22. And, you know, in the kind of life that I led for a lot of my life, you lose people along the way.
Yeah.
It just happens.
Yeah.
You know, so it was interesting because the year after this came out, my grandmother was dying, and I had an experience with loss that I had never had before, and it was that where you knew it was coming. And it's so different when you know that it's coming, when you have time to spend with that person and ask them questions and hear their stories and hear them again and again, in the case of my grandmother.
Yeah.
And just the same, when that moment comes, when they're gone, it's still the insides of you still crumble the same way.
Right.
It seemed, for me, it was easier somehow in the days following. And maybe that's where the benefit of preparation lies. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I was definitely, I've made an emotional recovery better.
Yeah.
From that than I did from either of the previous. Now, that could also have to do with the fact that I, you know, didn't use drugs and alcohol
right.
as my coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
But, so who knows?
Yeah.
Chickens and eggs, I don't know.
Yeah. You know, speaking of the idea of loss, when you finished the book, you know, when you sort of consciously realized, I just finished this book, was there, I mean, what kind of feelings did you go through? Was there a sense of loss? Was there, you know, I'm sure it was a mixed bag of emotions. What was it like for you?
I cried
uh-huh.
on the floor of my apartment. And I thought about where it began, and I looked over into my kitchen, and I saw, you know, the table that I was sitting at when I started writing it. And when I started writing, I didn't really know that's what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And overwhelming gratitude to be working with a company like Black Hill Press, who will allow me to write something with a character who has no name or no real physical description in places that are equally vague.
Right.
You know, with the narrative that is neither linear nor straightforward, you know, just gratitude.
Yeah.
It's overwhelming. I can't say enough good things about the experience of working with people whose primary goal is to help the writer achieve their vision.
Yeah.
Who does that?
Yeah, right. Well, Tyson Cornell here at Rare Bird Lit, actually, but, you know. yeah, no, it's actually a pretty rare thing. And it's a great thing, too, and it's definitely, when you find those type of people, you know, I work with Iris and Razor at Punk Hostage Press, and it's a similar thing. You know, they really value their writers, and they help them through every step of the process. And they are to be valued, they are to be cherished. Mm-hmm. And when you find people like that, you know, you really want to form that strong alliance and stick with them. You know, you mentioned before about the idea that when you were first working on the book, you didn't exactly know what it was going to be in the beginning. At what point did you know what it was going to be, and how did you then get through the process of completing the book?
So the way that this began is actually kind of an interesting story. I met Kevin Stanek from Black Hill Press quite a few years ago at a release party for a book that is ended with Right Bloody called The Good Things About America.
Uh-huh.
And I was at this party. They had a table of books for sale. I bought this book, and he said, "I'd really like to hear your thoughts about this." And I said, "Okay, be careful what you wish for."
Right.
And I went home, and I read this book cover to cover twice without stopping. And then I sent him a Word document of quite nearly every thought or feeling I had as I read the book. I gave him my experience as a reader. And so we started this very periodic correspondence, and it lasted a couple of years. And then one day, there'd be weeks and weeks between responses, and one day I sent him an email, and he had been talking to me about this book that he was working on, and I responded to his email, and I received a response from him in fewer than 2 minutes. And it said, "Have you ever written a novella?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Would you like to?" And I said, "Sure, about what?" And he said, "About everything that you just wrote to me about." So actually, if you look at Another Name for Autumn, so I didn't know where to begin. So the first chapter is actually verbatim the email that I sent him, with the exception of the last paragraph.
Wow.
So he said start there, so I did. I copied my email, I pasted it into a Word document, and I started there. And so the character and story are all basically crafted from the emotion of that first email. I had to create a world around that. So that's what I did. I created all of these playlists. I would drive around for hours and listen to playlists that I made that inspired me about the characters, and each character had their own playlist.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you should mention music, because that was actually something I wanted to talk to you about, because I mentioned before that sort of ethereal floating quality to the book. It almost felt like a piece of music, and I was actually wanting to ask you if you listened to music at all when writing.
I listened to only one piece of music while I was writing it, and I think that everyone should listen to it while they read it. If I could dictate the way this book should be read,
right,
I would say that it should be read while listening to a record called An Accidental Memory in the Case of Death by an artist named Alluvium.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Alluvium, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that I listened only to that when I wrote this.
Nice. But then you... So you listened to that only when you were writing, but then you just said that when creating characters or whatever, you would create separate playlists?
Yeah, for their story.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Like the characters, two of the characters in the story, in my head, their song is this song called Sippin' on Moonbeams by this band by the name of Julie.
Uh-huh.
It's a beautiful song. But that in my head, that was their song.
Right.
And it's like if they had forever, if they had that moment, that would be their song. And then I had, you know, playlists that just reminded me of her and things that she would love and songs that she would listen to if she's like, this is how I feel today, and songs that he would listen to, and it was fun.
So this might be sort of a which came first, the chicken or the egg sort of question, but... While on this topic, if you're coming up with characters, do you sort of in your head flesh out the character first or flesh it out through writing and then the music kind of comes to you? Or do you kind of use the music maybe as more of a starting point to help you get clearer on the character and their motivations? And
music helps me get clarity on characters.
Uh-huh. Nice. Nice.
And I seldom know exactly what I'm looking for. I just listen to a lot of music, and then when I hear it, I know it. I listen to music while I'm thinking or meditating on a character, and then when I hear something, for instance, the female character in Another Name for Autumn, there's a song by Poe called Beautiful Girl. And that song reminded me of that character.
Right.
So that song was on that character's playlist.
Nice.
And I didn't ever listen to it while I was writing, but while I was developing the story, I would listen to it and I would think, oh, well, how would she respond in this situation? How would she feel about this? You know, what would her next thought be here?
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Well, you know, actually, why don't we go ahead and have you read something from the book? You mentioned earlier that it was going to be, I think, an aspect of loss. And, you know, set it up in whatever way you would like or not.
No setup necessary.
Okay.
When my mother was gone, there was goodbye and there was a funeral. You don't always get to say goodbye. In the morning, when Finley left before it started to rain, I was in my studio and heard his steps toward the door. I jumped up and ran barefooted toward him in my white slip until my heart collided with his chest. He looked down at me, smiling, and put his arm around my waist. I laughed and told him I just needed to know one thing before he left. Oh, and what's that, funny girl? Do you love me? Every day until forever, he said. That's an awful long time, I replied. He asked me if I loved him back. I told him I would write him a love letter while he was gone and that it would be the best love letter that ever was because I loved him more than anyone ever loved anybody else. He kissed me on the forehead and walked outside. I worked on my painting for a while longer, then lay on the hardwood floor and wrote him a love letter on parchment. I still remember every word. Totem Captain. Since the beginning of time, people have been loving each other. I'd like to say I don't have the words to tell you how much I love you, but I do. And I say them to you every day. They sound like this. Good morning. Every time I say good morning to you, my heart fills with so much love that the only thing I can do is spend the rest of the day giving it to you. I spend the rest of the day filling the corners of our home with my love for you. When I make our tea, it is what fills our mugs, and it is your love for me that keeps us warm. I listen to your songs, and my heart fills still more, and when I sing my made-up words, they all mean I love you. When I paint, every color tells the story of our forever. The yellow is when I fall in love with your smile. Red, when seasons change and my love takes root deeper than eucalyptus in the ground. Blue is the color of the sky the day we walked in the rain and my heart fell from the clouds and came back to me. I will save other colors for another letter or a song I will sing to you in the morning, but because I know you will wonder, my love. Black is when I tell you I love you with my eyes closed. I dipped my fingers in paint, yellow and red and blue and black, and one by one I made fingerprint hearts on the page along the bottom where you're supposed to sign your name. I would have signed my name, but the day my heart came back to me, Finley told me my name is a song and I don't know how to write music. When I finished my letter, I folded it in half and set it on the piano's music desk where it would wait until Finley came home. I went back to painting. Until the day I left New England, the letter sat on the piano. Some days I thought about reading it, but I didn't need to because every word lived inside of me. Some days the rain would fill the ground outside of our home and I would hear it ask, "Do you love me back?" I would look at the sky and whisper, "Every day until forever, Totem Captain." I stopped going outside unless it was raining. When it rains, no one can see that your eyes are filled with tears and that your heart is full of holes. When it rained, I would sometimes sit outside, hoping my heart would fall silently from the sky again and come back to me. Sometimes the rain would sound like footsteps and my full-of-holes heart would flutter. It would feel like Finley was coming home. Rain takes shape around your body, making you sticky wet. The rain helps you pretend you aren't disappearing. I wonder if that was how Finley saw me that day in the rain. I wonder if he knew before we spoke that my heart was full of holes and it would fall from the sky that day and come back to me. That I was his forever and he was mine. Something happens when someone is gone. It doesn't matter whether there was goodbye or there was only a funeral. It doesn't matter if the funeral was filled with friends and family or if you were the only person there. When someone who lives in your heart disappears, they take you with them. You go. Because, more than anything, you don't want them to be gone. You go because you don't want to be alone. When you disappear with them, you get to keep them just a little while longer. The world becomes quiet and their voice is what wakes you instead of the sun. For a long time after Finley was gone, I would wake on New England mornings and reach across the empty space where his body would be too hot when the sun rose and mine would be too cold. I would say, "Good morning." I never got to tell him that good morning means I love you. I don't reach across the bed anymore. But when I wake, I still say good morning, even though I am alone.
That was beautiful. That was Corey Greathouse reading from Another Name for Autumn, released by Black Hill Press. You know, Corey, you mentioned love in there quite a few times. And speaking of great lines from the book, there was another one that really caught my attention. Everyone becomes more beautiful when they are loved. I was wondering if you could talk more about that idea.
Yeah. I think, firstly, it's important to say that that is not the kind of beautiful that I think a lot of people think about.
Right.
You know, it's not a sort of physical beauty. It's not as though someone is not physically beautiful because they, you know, feel unloved. It's just that radiance that comes from your heart feeling safe.
Yeah.
That there's a certain... You know, you can tell when you're looking at children and you're watching children play. You can tell the kids who really feel loved from the kids who wonder. And it's in the way they smile and it's in the way they play with each other. It's in a certain confidence that they have. And I think that there's a lot of freedom that comes with knowing you're loved. Not necessarily in the romantic way, but by your friends, by your family, by knowing that you are loved and valued for who you are and what you bring. And that what you bring does not have to be smiles and sunshine every day. Like, how cool is that? To know that you are loved even if you are unhappy.
Yeah.
That's really liberating.
Yeah.
You know, to not have to pretend to be happy every day. It's a really amazing experience to be loved that much and to feel that confident that your friends and your family love you.
Yeah.
And you to allow yourself to have whatever feelings you do on whatever day that is, and that can't help but create a sort of beauty that just shines.
Yeah. You know, this just popped into my head, so forgive me if it sounds a bit like a random question, but, you know, you were talking earlier about the idea of disappearing, and that was something that I noted too while reading the book, and you were also talking earlier about, you know, how in earlier times using drugs and alcohol, and I'm curious, and which also, you know, allows one to disappear in certain ways, and I'm curious if having gone through those experiences allowed you to maybe tap into the feeling more, the sensations more of disappearing that allowed you to then kind of channel that into this book, into that character. I mean, because the character in the book doesn't talk about, you know, drugs. It's not that kind of a book, but I'm just those sort of sensations, if that maybe allowed you to tap into it in a different way.
Perhaps. I would, yes and no. I mean, drugs and alcohol were an extraordinary part of my life. Extraordinarily eye-opening, extraordinarily painful, extraordinarily amazing to be free from them. But I think that the disappearing, the feeling invisible, the wanting to be invisible is something that's been in me since I was a little girl. When I was in first grade, I called a caucus of my girlfriends together on the playground, and I tried to explain to them that the person who they saw on the outside was actually not the real person that I was. And I tried to explain to them that this person who I was on the inside actually had different clothes, was quieter, and it didn't go over very well.
With this caucus of young girls.
It didn't go, it was not, I realize now that it was not really a conversation for my first grade friends.
Perhaps I should have saved that for fifth grade.
But it's so true. So I think that always existed.
That's a wise, not to interrupt, but that's a wise conversation to be having in first grade. The reason I've called you young ladies here today is because the person you are seeing on the outside is not quite the person on the inside. Oh, man.
Yeah, they had no idea what to do with me at that point. So I walked away sort of sad and dejected and sat on the bench and cried and was, you know, obviously upset that no one was coming to comfort me, but they all thought I was a weirdo then, you know. It's like, why isn't anyone coming to make me feel better? Well, because they'd maybe think you're a ghost or something at this point. I don't know. But, yeah, it was a very interesting day.
Yeah. You know, yeah, that is interesting. Okay. So, you know, here's an interesting thing, and it actually touches back to your work. When you were reading before, there's a fine poetic quality to the prose, and it takes me back to when I was first acquainted with you and your work. I knew you mostly as a poet, and these days it seems you're perhaps moving away from that to some degree, and I'm curious if you feel that's also the case, and if so, what do you feel is causing the shift?
I do feel that's the case. I love poetry. I have never really identified as a poet. When you and I met, I was writing a lot of vignettes, very short pieces, They're not quite poetry. They're not quite prose. There are lots, you know, like we talk about the missing elements of this, of Another Name for Autumn. There are a lot of missing elements in these little vignettes. I love them so much. And, you know, I think people didn't really know what to make of it. Or what, where to, which box to check. So I got the poetry box, right. And I love the poetry box. But I never really identified any of the work that was published as poetry, but I think that interpretation is so important, and so I would never tell anyone not to call it that.
Yeah.
You know, call it whatever you want, whatever's going to make you happy. If you like it, if you connect to it, great. You know? I mean, I have so many vignettes with these nameless characters and these very abstract situations and, you know, pages and pages of vignettes where the only thing that's really happening is someone sleeping.
Right.
And I love it. I love that stuff. And yeah, I like the I like literature and writing that doesn't always make you leave the house.
Yeah.
You know, you get to just stay inside and be with the dialogue or with the minds of the people, the characters that you're reading about.
Yeah.
I don't like it when I have to go outside and experience a lot of action and come back.
Right.
I think it's kind of fun to stay inside.
Yeah. Well, you know, on that note, speaking of writing forms, poetry, novella, and this is a novella, I'm curious, what do you like about working in the novella form and how it might serve you better than other writing forms when conveying ideas?
The novella form is kind of perfect, I think, for a lot of things that are going on right now. You know, we, even say here in Los Angeles, for instance, we're making moves toward more public transportation, you know, more mass transit. And if you have 15 or 20 minutes to read, you don't want to lug around a 500-page book. You know, 300 pages. I can fit a novella, you know, nice, neat, tidy 100 pages in my bag. If I was a man in larger jeans, I could put it in my pocket and head out the door. It's also really great for exploring genres that you wouldn't ordinarily read because it's not a huge commitment.
Right.
100 pages, I can read 100 pages of anything, really. You know, so it's great to explore new things. It's a nice, quick format. You know, you get that sense of accomplishment that comes with making progress in a book or finishing a book. It's like when there are a lot of books, I think, that are moving toward, in the last, like, I don't know, 20 years maybe, shorter and shorter chapters, right? And what I think is great about shorter chapters is that it allows people to feel like they're making progress. They feel like they're getting somewhere. They're getting some sort of internal reward from the progress that they're making in the book.
Yeah.
And shorter chapters help with that. I think novellas are also great for that. You can carry them around. You can make progress. You can finish a book. Some people haven't finished a book in years. It's great for those people.
Yeah. So before the show we were talking and you mentioned something that what you're working on now was originally going to be a sequel to Another Name for Autumn, but then at a certain point you decided to scrap that idea and write something else. I was wondering if you could talk a little about that experience, and is the next work going to be a novella?
Yes, the next work is going to be a novella. I'm also currently working on a proposal for a young adult memoir. about what happened in the, you know, about what it's like to go from being a 13-year-old honor student to a 14-year-old drug addict.
Wow.
And coming out of that. But the next novella...
Some of your first grade friends would be like, you know, I thought after that meeting Corey had with us about telling us something crazy about the person she was on the outside versus the inside, I saw next was going to come the drugs.
I know, it's so, I can't believe they missed that. The next novella is not going to be a sequel for Another Name for Autumn. It comes out in November 2014. Uh-huh. And it, the very loose premise of it is, it takes place over a 36-hour period of time, and it is two people who barely know each other,
mm-hmm.
sharing a very intimate, life-changing experience, that neither of them are ready for.
Wow, interesting. And it's also interesting that you're sort of compressing time like that. When you're doing something like that, does it allow you to kind of get more specific when details, when you're, you know, sort of compressing and slowing time down like that?
Yeah, I mean, it allows me to show, I think, more parts of... the internal journey that they're each experiencing, you know, because I don't have this huge plot to move through, I can really focus on the human experience and, you know, what they are experiencing as individuals and what they're experiencing together.
Yeah. You know, when I, the character in your book moves around a lot, and in your bio that I read at the top of the show, I mentioned, and you mentioned in your bio, that you're a reformed relocator, and I'm curious what you mean by that and what you've maybe learned through traveling and also staying still.
Roots are important for growing. That's what I've learned. We moved around quite a bit when I was a kid. And I mean, always, you know, within the same county, but, you know, we moved around quite a lot, and I moved every year just about until, I moved to Los Angeles, Santa Monica, I was in Santa Monica for 8 years. I'd never lived anywhere in my life for 8 years, and it was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing. There's this beautiful sense of familiarity and community and knowing the guys at the gas station and going and buying their overpriced gas because I like them and I want them to have jobs.
Right.
You know, there's this little boy, and he's in the book. There's a little boy and his father, and they would go for walks every day. I would hear them outside my bedroom window, and I was kind of a creeper, and I would look at them, and I got to watch this little boy grow up over the years, from when his father would carry him as they would walk to when he would go running off up ahead.
Wow.
Every day they would walk, they would go get coffee and muffin at Starbucks and walk home. And, you know, the magic of that was... And that might be one of the most autobiographical things in the book, is the comfort that she takes from their presence and there being a reminder to her that everything is right in the world, no matter how messed up it is, you know, no matter how horrible she feels. Every time she sees this little boy and his father, she's reminded that everything's all right.
Yeah,
And I definitely had that relationship with this little boy and his dad that they had no idea I had. And I gave the father a copy of the book when it came out, and he probably thinks I'm so strange. Because I just handed it to him, and I was like, hi, I just wanted to give this to you. This is my book. and you and your son inspired me. Have a good day. And I walked away. I actually saw him 1 year at the Oscars. I have no idea who he is or what his name is, but I saw him at the Oscars 1 year. And it kind of, ruined some of the magic. I was like, ew. I like you better when you're just walking your child.
Right.
I don't like to think that you're walking, you know, that you have all this time to spend with your son because, you know, you're making millions and millions of dollars. It was less romantic.
Oh, goodness. You know, another thing I mentioned in your bio at the top of the show that you volunteered for the School on Wheels program and the Adult Literacy program, I was hoping you could talk about those experiences, how you got involved, and perhaps what those experiences have taught you.
School on Wheels is amazing, and it's rough. I never had to have the experience of being a homeless child. And these kids are so incredible. It's a challenge for me because I get attached to them. And they're transient. You know, they move around.
Yeah.
The best thing that can happen is that they're going to leave. You know, because I'm tutoring them in the shelters. So my hope from the first time I meet these kids is that they have to leave my life.
Wow.
And that's, maybe it's masochistic of me. It's extraordinarily painful. But I get to help them with their homework. And, you know, I had this one student who just absolutely changed my life. You know, I sat down with his mother and he the first time, and his mother's telling me that he's not a very good kid, and he's in trouble all the time at school, and he just doesn't like to do work, and he just doesn't like to pay attention, and this and that, and he's in trouble all the time. I said, okay, you know, that's good to know. And I sat down, and we're doing some assessments so that I know where to begin in his studies, and I'm sitting there, and I'm wondering, is she really paying attention? Because this kid is so smart. So smart and so far ahead of where the other kids in his grade are. And so I, you know, after our first couple of sessions, I pulled his mom aside and I was like, so here's the thing. I think he's bored because your son is actually really, really smart. And always in our sessions, he was wanting to do things that his class wasn't doing yet.
Interesting.
You know, and I like doing esteem building exercises as well. Like, we make lists of things that they're really good at. He said one day, he said, well, I just want to be cool. And I said, okay, let's talk about what being cool is. What does that mean? And so we made a list of what makes someone cool. And he says, you know, nice glasses, nice clothes. And then he got to the real stuff that makes someone cool, you know, and he said, being helpful and being nice and doing things for other people and being a good brother and being a good son. And, you know, then we got to have a really great conversation around that. And, you know, I made a copy for him, and I made a copy for his mother. And I was like, maybe just hang on to this for when he has bad days. You know, and when he has a rough day at school, maybe you guys can revisit, like, what the coolest things about Sean are and what it means to be cool.
Wow.
And it's amazing. I love it.
That's great. Now, what about working with adults?
Adults are a different sort of challenge. I'm working with adults through the LA Public Library. Most of the adults that I've worked with are pretty literate in their first language.
Right.
So a lot of it is helping them with English, which is great because then they can help me.
Right.
You know, we get to help each other. I can learn from them. They can learn from me. So that's a lot of fun. And, you know, doing that, I feel like I'm really helping people to open economic opportunities for themselves. We work on filling out job applications and correcting if they, you know, they will sometimes come to me wanting to correct the way that they say certain words. So we practice that. We'll practice particular words or phrases. But mostly that's about helping people to become who they want to be, and by helping them, you know, gain better English skills.
Right. Right. Interesting. So you, by the way, just commendable work. I'm a teacher myself, so I can, you know, really just, I know the hard work that's involved, but I also, you know firsthand the rewards, and they are great. You recently went to AWP. I'm curious how that experience was for you. Also, earlier you mentioned it was after AWP that gave you that realization that you wanted to scrap the idea of writing the sequel for Another Name for Autumn, and I'm curious, what was the experience at AWP that caused that shift?
AWP was so incredible, and I thought I was going to hate it. I thought I was going to be miserable. I'm not really into crowds or even people all that much. I do.
Should
really
I just leave now?
No. I do really well one-on-one or in small groups. I'm not really into large groups of people. They make me nervous. But I had the best time at AWP, and we completely sold out of my book, and then we sold out of the copies that Black Hill Press bought, and then I said, well, I have a couple. You can buy them back for me, and then you can sell them. And so then they sold those, and then I had to reach out to a friend of mine who lived locally and say, hey, do you have any unread copies of my book hanging around? Because I need them.
Wow.
So I'm commandeering copies from a friend to sell. And it was great.
And then
great.
You bought them from the people who had already bought them, and you resold them for a little bit more.
It was wonderful. I got to talk to so many writers and so many readers. And I really enjoyed the thing I thought I would hate the most, which was hanging out in the booth. Turns out, it was perfect for me. I could hang out there all day.
Mm-hmm.
I left most of the panels that I went to, and I loved being in the booth, because I realized only recently that probably the reason I like that is because it's basically the same as my strategy at parties, right? Find a place, sit there, and then when people come by who want to talk to me, talk to them.
Yeah.
It's great. And Black Hill Press does so many different genres. And there are 12 books now. So I got to talk to a lot of readers and help them to find the book within the Black Hill Press collection that might be right for them. So that was a lot of fun. Like,
wow.
Oh, what do you like? Okay, you might like this. You might like this. It was like working in a bookstore, which I've always wanted to do. But Barnes & Noble wouldn't hire me. In the 90s, it was really sad.
They're lost. They're lost. You know, so we're getting close to the end of our time, but I want to ask you one last question. You know, having gone through the experiences you've gone through, and, you know, dealing with certain joys and challenges of writing, if you had to offer some advice perhaps to a young writer, an aspiring writer, what would be some things you'd say?
Read.
Uh-huh.
Your voice is valid. Your feelings are valid. Your perspective is valid. And when you tell yourself that it's not, you're lying. The most important thing you can do is to keep writing. Sit down and write, not when you're inspired, But even when you're not,
yeah,
irrespective of how you feel, do the work, and you will reach your goal.
That's it. And on that note of validity and writing and reaching your goal, with me today has been Corey Greathouse. We've been talking about her latest release, Another Name for Autumn, out on Black Hill Press. Corey, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been so good to be here.
Yeah, also I want to send out a big thank you to our show sponsor for all your writerly needs. Please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julie at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also a big thanks to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voicing. You can find them online at wevoicing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, Spotify, and Twitter. Speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicing.com, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth in Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week when I'll be featuring a roundtable discussion with various LA writers that also host reading series around Los Angeles. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.